Viewpoint on Mormonism, the program that examines the teachings of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints from a biblical perspective. Viewpoint on Mormonism is sponsored by Mormonism Research Ministry. Since 1979, Mormonism Research Ministry has been dedicated to equipping the body of Christ with answers regarding the Christian faith in a manner that expresses gentleness and respect. And now, your host for today's Viewpoint on Mormonism.
Welcome to this edition of Viewpoint on Mormonism. I'm your host, Bill McKeever, founder and director of Mormonism Research Ministry. With me today is Corey Anderson, pastor of Shadow Mountain Church in West Jordan, Utah. We are continuing our look at a blog article by a Mormon named Greg Trimble. It is titled 51 Questions That Might Lead You to Mormonism. And if you're just tuning in to this series, you might want to go to our website, mrm.org, and click on the icon that says On Air, and there you will be able to see all of our past broadcasts dealing with this subject matter. Today, we are looking at question number 42, where Mr. Trimble asks the question, why do so many ancient North, Central, and South American Indian traditions cite the appearance and ministration of a great god, and that's in quotes, that visited their ancestors many years ago and promised to return again? Now, I think what I want to do with this, Corey, is tie it in with what I think he's doing with question number 43, which reads, why do the explorers and conquistadors credit their ability to conquer the Indians of the Americas to their belief that the conquistadors were that great god returning? Do you think he's really taking quite a stretch there in trying to use this as a proof for the Book of Mormon?
Yeah, I think it is quite a stretch. I mean, again, can you prove the tie and prove the connection? That's a big challenge. I find it striking with just Book of Mormon archaeology, period, that this is the kind of thing that they do. It's sort of the best thing that they can do. Because of the complete absence of anything really definitive in terms of archaeologically, they have to find sort of any correspondence that they can have, whether that's a topographical correspondence. You know, we read in said chapter of the Book of Mormon that there's a mountain range and a valley and a river. Let's find on a map somewhere now where there's a mountain range and a valley and a river. Now we have a correspondence, therefore that must be the place it took place.
You make a good point. In Mormonism, it's basically understood to be parallelisms.
Yes.
You know, we find some kind of parallel and we tie it into the Book of Mormon, and that somehow gives validity to the Book of Mormon story. I'm assuming, and though he doesn't mention the proper name here in his questions, but I think Mr. Trimble may be making a veiled reference to Quetzalcoatl, which was known in Central American folklore as the plumed serpent. That's where the name comes from. And somehow they assume that the Native Americans in Central America were looking forward to this Quetzalcoatl or this plumed serpent, this deity coming back. However, I don't find a lot of Mormons using that argument anymore. In fact, I find many of them actually kind of distancing themselves from this. That was an argument that was propagated more like from guys like Milton R. Hunter and Dewey Farnsworth. And I don't find a lot of Mormon apologists looking at those arguments as being very credible, even though Milton R. Hunter tried to use some of these arguments in a conference message that he gave. But even if it's true that the conquistadors felt that they were able to conquer the Indians, according to the belief that some great god was going to return, how does that somehow validate that this is talking about Jesus' appearance in the New World after his resurrection? Again, I think it's quite a stretch. He then goes from the Book of Mormon, and now he's going to look at Joseph Smith as a prophet. So in question number 44, it says, if the polygamous history of Mormonism is a deal breaker, then why do you still believe in the Bible? Remember, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, David, Solomon, and others that are esteemed from the Bible. What would you say about that? I mean, I guess he's trying to argue if you don't like the idea that Joseph Smith practiced polygamy, then what do you do with all these other people that are mentioned in the Bible that we assume did practice?
Well, he provides a bit of a short list here for us to evaluate. And so we could look at a couple of these right offhand, and we could scratch a couple of these names off really quickly because they were doing certain things that were wrong. For example, David and Solomon, both kings of Israel, were actually forbidden by God to have more than one wife. That text is found in Deuteronomy 17, verse 16 and 17, where God specifically commanded them, "Neither shall he multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away." So the kings are ruled out. It's a command not to actually be polygamist. In terms of Isaac, Isaac was not a polygamist, if you read the biblical account. In terms of God's, in terms of Abraham, if we look at Abraham, certainly Abraham was with Sarah, but she couldn't conceive. So she said, "Here, take my handmaiden, my servant, Hagar." But there's no indication that he was married to her. He just had an illicit relationship with her.
Yeah, I think they take that word wife, take her as your wife, but it's not in like a marriage ceremony. In fact, Abraham never refers to Hagar as being his wife. He always refers to her as being Sarah's servant. So certainly there would be a problem with that.
And even if, let's just hypothetically say that he did have her as his wife, there are many things that saints did in the Old Testament from the time of the fall of Adam and Eve all the way through to this present day that are not pleasing to God, but they're cultural. Certainly in Abraham's day, it's not like polygamy wasn't something that was in existence in culture either.
Well, let's take the case of David and Bathsheba. Bathsheba's married, and God punishes David for that.
Yes.
And yet we know now the church has admitted that Joseph Smith did in fact marry married women. So if it's a deal breaker, I would say, well, yeah, because you're saying that it was okay for Joseph Smith to do something that David certainly was punished for.
Correct. Yes.
And yet we know that he not only had married women included in his list of polygamous wives, and then he's marrying teenagers. And then Mormons try to excuse that like that was almost customary to marry young girls. And that was very rare. It wasn't unheard of, but it was certainly very rare. So I would say it was a deal breaker, mainly because we don't find anywhere in the Old Testament where God actually commands polygamy. And if you don't do it, you're not going to be exalted. That's exactly what Brigham Young said. The only men who become gods or even the sons of God are those who enter into polygamy. It was a command from God. And the Mormon Church keeps insisting that to this day. In one of their gospel topic essays about polygamy, they say that it was commanded in the Old Testament. It's not commanded in the Old Testament at all.
And in terms of the LDS viewpoint on that, would that be what we'd find out of Doctrine and Covenants 132?
That would be section 132. That's where the revelation on plural marriage is found. Now, Mormons do redefine what celestial marriage is today. Celestial marriage is usually understood by Latter-day Saints as merely referring to marriage for time and eternity, even though originally that phrase was more in context of plural marriage.
So we could go back, I assume, at some earlier sort of speeches, writings of how they interpreted D&C 132 and find them.
Certainly. Fudging on the definitions, that's for sure.
Yes.
That's for sure.
I think the last piece I just want to mention briefly about this plural marriage idea is that if you look at every example of plural marriage in the Bible, it's not a happy home.
No.
It's just when you step out of God's plan for marriage, and pastorally to look at this, whenever we step out of God's plan, period of anything, it just tends to be not a very good life of happiness.
We find that even in the history of Mormonism, that with Joseph Smith's plural wives, there tended to be tension. And even in modern polygamous homes that are so highlighted on television nowadays, you find also that there's tension in those relationships as well. Question number 45. Joseph Smith was free and clear from the mob and on the other side of the Mississippi River when he was summoned to go to Carthage to die. If you were an evil villain imposter, would you go back to Carthage or would you save your own skin? Now, to give you a little bit of context here, Carthage would be the county seat, and this is where Joseph Smith was going to go to turn himself in after being charged with riot for destroying the Nauvoo Expositor, which was a newspaper that was put together by seven men who were once loyal to Joseph Smith and certainly were not loyal to him any longer. So Joseph Smith is trying to get away from going to jail, and so he crosses the Mississippi River into Montrose, Iowa. And just to give you a little background on this, Mr. Trimble says, would you go back to Carthage, assuming that he thinks he's going to die? did he really think he was going to die? I know there's this romantic phrase that he's going as a lamb led to the slaughter. I personally question whether or not he really said that. A lot of this is written after the fact, and we do know that the Mormons did romanticize their history in many areas. But did he even know for sure that he was going to die? That's a great question. But I think this would probably play to his pride, wouldn't you, Corey? Because we do know that Emma sends a letter to Joseph Smith, who's on the other side of the Mississippi, has a courier send it over to him. And in the letter, she said, "The saints think you are a coward. They are charging that you are running away." Wouldn't that kind of play to his ego, you think?
It sure seems like it would play to his ego. I mean, he's got something to uphold here, and he's got a reputation at stake. And boy, for a man of sort of known character, I can certainly see that feeding into his ego and him needing to go back and prove otherwise.
Yeah, I don't think that that's all that strong of an argument when you look at all the historical facts behind what actually happened. Question number 46. They found the Book of Mormon that Joseph and Hiram had in Carthage Jail with the page turned down that they read from before they died. Hiram, other than Joseph, would have known best if it was a fraud. If you were Hiram, would you read from a fraudulent book in your last days? Doesn't this kind of assume they really thought and knew for sure it was going to be their last days?
Yeah, it does really assume that. And what about the others that were there as well? And were all of them aware that this was a fraud, all of the ones that were in jail with him? I mean, is it possible that some of them needed to maintain this facade or this image even?
Well, that's a great point, because Joseph Smith had found himself in precarious situations before, and he still continued perpetuating what we would call the ruse. But, you know, when it talks about in your last days, again, it's assuming they know for a fact they're going to die. I don't know if Joseph Smith really felt that. If he really thought he was going to die that day, why is he taking precautions to hopefully prevent it when he accepts the gun that Cyrus Wheelock gives him earlier in the day? Not only the Ethan Allen pepper box he takes from Cyrus Wheelock, he also takes the Derringer and gives that to his brother Hiram. Maybe Smith was thinking if push came to shove, he was going to shoot his way out of this situation. Again, we don't know, and I think there are a lot of assumptions have to be made in order to draw that conclusion.
Thank you for listening. If you would like more information regarding Mormonism Research Ministry, we encourage you to visit our website at www.mrm.org, where you can request our free newsletter, Mormonism Researched. We hope you will join us again as we look at another viewpoint on Mormonism. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, known as the Mormon Church, is a huge topic of interest among many Bible-believing Christians who want to reach their LDS loved ones or friends with the biblical message of hope and grace. If you're a Christian who wants to be better informed about the beliefs of the Mormon people, Mormonism Research Ministry wants to be a resource for you. Since 1979, Mormonism Research Ministry has worked hard to clearly articulate Mormon doctrine and history in order to better understand the issues that separate Mormonism from the Christian faith. At MRM.org, we have links to an active blog site, as well as dozens of articles and videos that will help educate you on this fascinating topic. Should your church need a live presentation, we can do that too. Contact MRM to schedule one of our PowerPoint presentations at MRM.org or call our office at 801-572-2153. That's 801-572-2153. Let MRM help you become a confident ambassador for Christ.